I'm Mark Hennick. This is So-Called Normal. We all feel and experience the pressures of life. Over these past few months, while the world lives through a global pandemic, it's only added to and amplified these everyday stresses. Over the next 30 minutes or so, you're going to hear the story of how mental illness can change lives, and how dealing with mental illness can take various forms. In fact, it can be a long and winding road for many people with treatment-resistant depression, who find particular challenges in that complex treatment pathway to recovery. The journey begins with the problem, but treating that problem is often a time-consuming and frustrating experience for many patients. It can take weeks, months, or years to find that balance again. Sometimes, sadly, that balance is never found. Aiden is a student at the University of New Brunswick in Fredericton. He is preparing to return to his studies this fall.
You've been there for 3 years, but my understanding is that you started to struggle with your mental health quite a lot earlier than that, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, on and off through my youth, mental health had been a struggle for me. I'd been hospitalized a few times during elementary school for just times when mental health really flared up, and I couldn't cope, and through high school things got a little better, and generally things were pretty okay during a lot of high school and first year, and then second year things flared up again, and I had a pretty rough time, but not now. I seem to be doing a little bit better.
When did it all start for you? How old were you?
The first time I was hospitalized was when I was 8 years old. I was in grade 3, and it was in February, the end of February, I believe. So I just turned 8, and I think that just generally I was in a pretty rough state. I was my moods were very extreme, and I don't really remember too much, unfortunately. But I think just generally my moods were pretty extreme, and I wasn't able to cope well.
Yeah. What was going on in your life at that time? Were things pretty good at home and at school, and this came out of nowhere, or was there other stuff happening too?
I think school has always been a big stressor for me. I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and when I can't do things perfectly, which is all the time, I get a bit frustrated. And when I was that young, I didn't really know how to deal with that that well. So,
did your teachers recognize what was happening?
I think so. Yeah, I think a lot of my teachers had recognize that and been able to accommodate that a little bit, but yeah.
So who was the first, or I guess which order did it go in? Did you tell people that you felt like you needed help? I mean, you're only 8 years old, right? Or did others notice and then talk to you about it?
No. So at that point, when I was 8, it was more other people noticed. My dad noticed, my parents noticed, and they, you know, kind of said, okay, we're going to go to the hospital and sort this out. And I really, at that age, I wasn't able to recognize how extreme things were. And I was pretty against taking medication, against the fact, against therapy at that point, and reaching out for other mental health resources, just because I thought, you know, everyone else, you know, my brother doesn't, for example, my brother doesn't have to, you know, do this. Why do I have to do this?
Right.
And I think that kind of over the years, I've come to reckon, like, especially after high school, beginning of first year, I was very proactive at university. You know, I was, you know, to reach out for resources, just because I came to recognize, yeah, there's some things that it can actually be pretty helpful for. Mm-hmm. And like medication definitely helps.
That first visit to hospital, what was that like for you? Do you remember much about that experience?
I don't remember too much. I remember mainly that I was very angry, and I didn't really want to be there, and I didn't really think that, you know, I needed to be there. But I think that, you know, generally things were pretty out of whack with my day-to-day life, and I wasn't coping. And I think that probably a more, you know, I was 8 years old then, a little bit with a little more life experience, I think is probably a good idea at that point to have been hospitalized.
So what did they do for you? You were admitted to hospital, were you?
Yeah.
Okay. And what did they do? What kind of treatment did you receive when you were admitted?
A lot of, talked to a lot of therapists, psychiatrists and therapists. I remember doing a lot of, you know, worksheets about, you know, about anger management, anger issues, about, you know, how my body feels when I get angry, for example, or you know, physical symptoms, and definitely we tried to rule out things, try to get a clear diagnosis of what I had, what mental health diagnosis I had, and in the end, like I was tested for Asperger's syndrome, and I'd shown symptoms of that, but that wasn't what I had. But I definitely worked a lot with psychiatrists to try and get a medication that worked for me.
Right. So did they ever did they figure out what the diagnosis was?
Yeah. So I most recently I've been you know, given a few opinions through the years from different doctors, but most recently the understanding is that I have bipolar 2. So they're two kind of different versions of bipolar, and bipolar 1 is a little more is where moods are maybe a little more volatile, where people experience manic episodes, really severe manic episodes, and then really severe depressive episodes, and bipolar 2 is sort of like that from my understanding, but a little more toned down. Yeah.
Which is worse for you, the experiences of kind of the low-level mania or depression? Because depression is always a part of bipolar disorder. Which bothers you more?
I would say kind of manic episodes. When I'm manic, I kind of lose. I don't judge the situations as well, I think, and that can be problematic.
Sure. When you were discharged from hospital that first time, you left on medication. You were prescribed a medication.
Yeah.
Okay. And how did your body respond to that, or how did your mind respond to that?
So actually, the first medication I was given, I've been given several through the years, is the same medication I'm on now, and in terms of symptoms, it doesn't have many symptoms that have shown up in me. There definitely been other medications where that have made me tired during the day, or I remember one that I was on made me gain a little bit of weight. But as far as medications go, the one I'm on now, which is the same one I was given on my first hospitalization, is pretty symptom free.
Can you talk a little bit more about that, the side effects piece, and how was it disrupting your life?
Yeah, sure. So I mean, one huge thing is like when I get tired during the day. That's been like kind of daytime fatigue has been a side effect that I've experienced with several medications, and obviously that's pretty disruptive. You don't want to be, you know, napping away in math class or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that definitely kind of on and off through the years, there have been certain medications that have made me quite tired, have made me tired at times where I should be pretty attentive.
Dr. Jennifer Swainson is a general adult psychiatrist in Edmonton, Alberta. In addition to her clinical work, Dr. Swainson teaches medical students and residents in psychiatry. She is also an active researcher with a particular focus on treatment-resistant depression. She's recently authored and co-authored several publications on this topic. Her other major research area is in the interactions between diet and mental health, and it's my real honor to have her join me on the show today to talk about complex treatment pathways for depression. Dr. Swainson, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mark.
Most people would recognize that the frontline treatment for depression, at least at the first presentation, is often antidepressants of some kind or another. But how does either a psychiatrist or a family or any kind of physician make that decision in terms of the initial treatment? How do they know what to prescribe or how much of it to prescribe to that individual person?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. So, as you said, certainly medications are a first-line treatment for depression. I just want to point out as well that, you know, for more mild to moderate depression especially, sometimes talk therapy can be enough without medication. But most of the time, taking an antidepressant medication as well can basically help someone to be able to do whatever other therapy that they would need. So usually it's a combination approach. As far as which medication to prescribe, you know, there's lots of different antidepressants out there. You know, we've got research on, you know, efficacy and tolerability, meaning, you know, what's least likely to cause side effects. With most antidepressants, they're probably fairly equivalent in terms of how well they work for the most part. What does differ is their side effect profile. Hmm. So, as a psychiatrist, most of the time when I'm, you know, when I'm choosing a medication, I'm thinking, what is least likely to cause side effects for this individual patient? Because a medication is not going to work if somebody doesn't take it, and they're not going to take it if it causes side effects that make them miserable.
Right. Now, I assume you've probably encountered this where the side effect profile of a particular medication either is ruled out from prescribing it in the first place, or they're taken off of it, off of that medication or changed dosage, because maybe the side effect is actually contributing to the problem that is their primary concern to begin with, right? That, you know, if they're, for example, if they're, one of their primary complaints is inability to sleep, and the antidepressant that they're given is giving them difficulty sleeping, then obviously that's not helping their primary concern. Does that happen fairly often?
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely it does. And, you know, although antidepressants are, you know, fairly equivalent in terms of how well they work for most people, you know, they all have sort of different characters in terms of how activating they might be or how sedating they might be or how good they might be for any anxiety that goes along with it. So certainly you have to really look at what someone's primary symptoms are and what their concerns are and say if they are already on a medication, could this medication be contributing? You know, is it causing insomnia? And if it is it just a matter of timing? You know, if they move it to take it in the morning instead of evening, would that look after that problem? Mm. Or, you know, if they're really tired and fatigued during the day, is it because they're on a medication that's causing some sedation? And it's variable even person to person, right? I mean, somebody can take an antidepressant and feel really sedated on it, and then the next person will have sort of the opposite effect. So there are individual differences that I think probably, you know, make that part of the challenge in treating depression effectively.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, some medications, and I don't usually hear this talked about very often. That's partly why I want to raise it. Some medications are commonly prescribed off-label for the side effects that they provide. Within the mental health space, several of the people that we've talked to already, and I myself have experienced this as a service user when I was a teenager, antipsychotics being prescribed to help people sleep or to help people with agitation. We've heard stories about them being used quite extensively in long-term care settings as well, to help people who are irritable and agitated. How common, or what is there a clinical guideline of some sort around using medications off-label, from their intended purpose, like antipsychotics, to use that example?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say there's a clinical guideline necessarily, but we do have. When you look at different forms of depression and what types of symptoms somebody may have, we do know clinically that certain symptom clusters respond, for example, to the addition of an atypical antipsychotic. Something like, for example, if someone has depression with what we'd call sort of mixed features, which has a lot of anxiety and agitation and someone who's quite sort of revved up and irritable at the same time they're depressed, that person is not really going to respond very well just to an antidepressant alone. They will most likely need what we'd call an adjunctive treatment, adding on an atypical antipsychotic as well. So we do have recommendations in terms of treatment when there are different comorbidities, different conditions kind of co-occurring. But you are correct. There is a lot of off-label use of medications in psychiatry.
Aiden is no stranger to the scenario described by Dr. Swainson. He's had promising results with a combination of therapy and medication.
So trying all the coming off the original medication, trying all these other medications, what was it that either the doctors or you or your parents or whoever weren't quite satisfied with in terms of the progress? Why wasn't it good enough?
Well, I think that, at various points, like despite being on medication, there were situations that would kind of make my moods flare up and I still, reacted pretty severely in those situations. And I guess this is a nice little segue to the other therapy side of things, which obviously medication is helpful, but I think just it's not magic, and there are kind of coping skills that I've picked up through the years, which help out as well to kind of deal with overwhelming emotion.
Yeah. So trying all those different medications, it sounds like, to find some sort of emotional stability. Because if you're all over the map, it's hard to lead in a regular everyday life if your emotions are always so unpredictable. But then layering in the therapy too. So what kinds of did you try any specific kinds of therapy, or eclectic different kinds of things?
Yeah. So the therapy I've done most recently is dialectical behavioral therapy. And that has been suggested by actually a few doctors, and my condition, it's been known to work quite well, and I think that it does help. It gets to kind of the core of what's causing you to feel overwhelming emotion, and how to deal with that properly.
How long have you been doing DBT?
I've been doing it for maybe a year, a little over a year.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And you notice a difference then, it sounds like?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah. Throughout all of this, you know, in and out of hospital, having crises, the mood instability, all the different medications, how did your parents respond to your struggles?
They've been very supportive. I mean, we've butted heads over the years a few times, for sure. Generally speaking, earlier on in earlier episodes where I'd struggled with mental health issues, I was kind of against the idea of medication, and I kind of thought, you know, I'm just like everyone else. I shouldn't have to do this if, you know, so-and-so is not doing this, but I think, over the years, I've kind of come to recognize that there are certainly some benefits to taking medication or doing therapy for my own needs, I think my parents have been super supportive. There are times that we'll kind of get in arguments over what is the best approach, I guess, to dealing with my mental health, but lately, at least, things lately being definitely the past few years, things have been working in harmony with regards to dealing with mental health with my parents.
Did you ever feel, you know, throughout this journey, that you didn't have any options, that you had tried everything, or, you know, that it was hopeless? Did you ever have those moments?
I mean, maybe briefly, but overall, I've been I'd say pretty optimistic that there, you know, if the right resources are out there, that things will be fine in the end, and you know, sure enough, I think that, yeah, you know, there have been times where I've gotten quite down, where I've been very depressed, but I've always worked my way out of those situations, and I'd say, you know, medication and mental health professionals have helped a great amount with that.
So they've you've probably encountered lots of different doctors, and both GPs and psychiatrists and nurses and all kinds of health professionals along the way. Have they all been fairly understanding and supportive, or have there been times where you just felt like they didn't get it?
For the most part, they've been supportive. I think that the one thing I'll say on that topic is that there's certain, especially with counselors or therapists, there's certain counselors that you can work with, and that's great. And there's sometimes, you know, there's just not that working relationship. Either personalities are not, you know, not compatible with each other, or what have you, and that sometimes leads to kind of frustrating therapy sessions or you know, kind of dysfunctional therapy sessions. And so, like, I think that the one kind of issue I've had with mental health professionals is sometimes just the personality or the approach of the professional is a little problematic, or causes conflict with me.
Yeah, it might work for other people, but it doesn't work for you.
Yeah, that's what I'd say.
Yeah, you know, that's a really great insight, and I don't think it's one that everybody learns either very early on or at all. Sometimes people will go to a therapist, have a bad experience, and think that all of therapy is just not for them, when really every therapist is different. So how did you learn that? How did you find out that it depends on the therapist?
I'd say mainly through trial and error. I mean, you know, going back and having an open mind, I'd say. So early on in earlier in my life, when my mental health would flare up, there were, you know, I was not very open-minded, and that made therapy just a heck of a lot more difficult. And, you know, kind of as I matured throughout high school and going into university, I tried to keep a little more open mind, and that certainly seemed to help with kind of saying, okay, I'm going to deal with this. I'm going to be mature about it.
Dr. Christina Iglesia is a clinical psychologist based out of the San Francisco Bay Area. Her primary focus is on families like Aiden's. She works with adolescents and young adults. In her spare time, she's the founder of the hashtag Therapy is Cool Mental Health Action Campaign. She aims to raise awareness around mental health. We spoke to her about the importance of connection between patient and therapist.
Can you tell me a bit about the role of the therapeutic alliance, about trust with the Yep. client, of getting to know each other, potentially as a mechanism of recovery, of action?
Yeah, change. Yeah. I always tell people in the first session, you know, whether this is a good business practice or not, I have no idea. But I always tell people in the first session that this is just as much about me getting to know them as them getting to know me and making a decision if this is going to be a good fit. I have yet to see any kind of therapeutic change happen when there is a misalignment between person and therapist.
Turns out you can't do recovery to people, it turns out.
Nope. I mean, I haven't seen it yet. So you have to feel, even at the simplest level, some ability to open up and share with the person that's sitting across from you. And if that isn't apparent in session one, I tell people, here's a list of referrals. I want you to find somebody that's going to work for you, because what a disservice it would be for that person to continue to show up and not have any traction because there was a mismatch between our personalities, our temperaments, the way that I work, the way they need to receive the work. So the therapeutic alliance, the therapeutic rapport, is absolutely the vehicle for change. I think that people might disagree, but I stand by, if you can have trust with your therapist, if you can have trust with the individual that is in the room with you, you can truly process and progress to places you never thought you could do, and potentially places you never thought you would be able to as an individual if you were to do the work yourself. So the power of change is in that relationship, and that's why it's so important to continue to seek support until you find the right therapist.
Is your approach to therapy or recovery or treatment such that everybody can get better, we just don't know how yet? Or are there some people who just won't get better?
I have to believe that everybody can get better, because if I viewed it any other way, this would not be the profession that I'm called to be in. I have to believe that even if people haven't gotten better yet, that that door is never fully closed. People can struggle with something, let's say, for example, addiction for 10 years, right? And everyone around them can say, you're not going to get better. You're not going to quit. You're never going to have recovery. And then year 11, they're sober, and then they spend the next 40 years, you know, without doing drugs and alcohol. So who are we to say that anybody ever can't get better? It's really about continuing to provide options and treatment and making mental health accessible for people, so that even if we have failed certain treatments, there's still other ones available. Even if certain medications haven't worked, there's other ones available. Even if certain therapeutic modalities haven't worked, there's other ones available. We need to give people options and resources and avenues so that they are never at a point where there is no hope, and that they truly begin to believe that they can't get better. Because when somebody believes they can't get better, the truth is they won't.
As for Aiden, university awaits, and his journey continues. He knows, in addition to his academics and preparing for a career, he's also acquiring the tools to cope and live the best life that he can.
personally, you're an inspiration to me, even if for no other reason than the grit and resilience, as you said, and determination that you've brought to this. That hopefulness and optimism, I think, is a message that more people need. I think if more people stick it out, eventually, like you, they'll be on the path to success. So I want to thank you for sharing with me.
Yep, not a problem.
All right. Thanks, Aidan.
You've been listening to a special episode of So-Called Normal with Mark Hennick. If you like what you heard, share the episode with others. You can always follow Mark on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Instagram at Mark Hennick. Otherwise, you might want to check out his website, markhennick.com. This special series of So-Called Normal has been produced by Mark Hennick and Eye Contact Productions. I'm Dave Trafford.
This episode of So-Called Normal is brought to you by an educational grant from Janssen, Inc. Mark Hennick and the producers of So-Called Normal are solely responsible for the content of the episode, and the views and opinions expressed in this episode do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Janssen, Inc. The podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition, product, or treatment. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have read or seen in this podcast episode.